Poole, apparently the same person as Tiglath-Pileser III, is, according to the Bible narrative, the first Assyrian monarch to appear upon the Hebrew horizon, and Menahem buys him off with 1,000 talents of silver in 738 BC. But the power of Assyria is heading straight for the now aged and decadent land of Egypt, and the line of attack lies through Judea. Tiglath-Pileser III returns, and Shalmaneser follows in his steps. The king of Israel intrigues for help with Egypt, that broken reed, and in 721 BC, as we've already noted, his kingdom is swept off into captivity and utterly lost to history. The same fate hung over Judah, but for a little while it was averted. The fate of Sennacherib's army in the reign of King Hezekiah, 701 BC, and how he was murdered by his sons, 2 Kings 19:37, we've already mentioned. The subsequent subjugation of Egypt by Assyria finds no mention in Holy Writ, but it's clear that before the reign of Sennacherib, King Hezekiah had carried on a diplomatic correspondence with Babylon, 700 BC, which was in revolt against Sargon II of Assyria. There followed the conquest of Egypt by Esarhaddon, and then, for a time, Assyria was occupied with her own troubles. The Scythians and Medes and Persians were pressing her on the north, and Babylon was in insurrection. As we've already noted, Egypt, relieved for a time from Assyrian pressure, entered upon a phase of revival, first under Psammeticus and then under Necho II. Again, the little country in between made mistakes in its alliances, but on neither side was there safety. Josiah opposed Necho and was slain in the Battle of Megiddo, 608 BC. The king of Judah became an Egyptian tributary. Then, when Necho, after pushing as far as the Euphrates, fell before Nebuchadnezzar II, Judah fell with him, 604 BC. Nebuchadnezzar, after a trial of 3 puppet kings, carried off the greater part of the people into captivity in Babylon, 586 BC. And the rest, after a rising and a massacre of Babylonian officials, took refuge from the vengeance of Chaldea in Egypt. And all the vessels of the house of God, great and small, and the treasures of the house of the Lord, and the treasures of the king and of his princes, all these he brought to Babylon. And they burnt the house of God, and brake down the wall of Jerusalem, and burnt all the palaces thereof with fire, and destroyed all the goodly vessels thereof. And them that had escaped from the sword carried he away to Babylon, where they were servants to him and his sons, until the reign of the kingdom of Persia. 2 Chronicles 36:18, 19, and 20. So, the 4 centuries of Hebrew kinship comes to an end. From first to last, it was a mere incident in the larger and greater history of Egypt, Syria, Assyria, and Phoenicia. But out of it, there were now to arise moral and intellectual consequences of primary importance to all mankind. Third, the Jews who returned after an interval of more than 2 generations to Jerusalem from Babylonia in the time of Cyrus were a very different people from the warring Baal worshippers and Jehovah worshippers, the sacrificers in the high places and sacrifices at Jerusalem of the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. The plain fact of the Bible narrative is that the Jews went to Babylon barbarians and came back civilized. They went a confused and divided multitude with no national self-consciousness. They came back with an intense and exclusive national spirit. They went with no common literature generally known to them, for it was only about 40 years before the captivity that King Josiah is said to have discovered a book of the law in the temple, 2 Kings 22. And besides that, there's not a hint in the record of any reading of books, and they returned with most of their material for the Old Testament. It's manifest that, relieved of their bickering and murderous kings, restrained from politics, and in the intellectually stimulating atmosphere of that Babylonian world, the Jewish mind made a great step forward during the captivity. It was an age of historical inquiry and learning in Babylonia. The Babylonian influences that had made Sardanapalus collect a great library of ancient writings in Nineveh were still at work. We've already told how Nabonidus was so preoccupied with antiquarian research as to neglect the defense of his kingdom against Cyrus. Everything, therefore, contributed to set the exiled Jews inquiring into their own history, and they found an inspiring leader in the prophet Ezekiel. From such hidden and forgotten records as they had with them, genealogies, contemporary histories of David, Solomon, and their other kings, legends and traditions, they made out and amplified their own story and told it to Babylon and themselves. The story of the creation and the flood, much of the story of Moses, much of Samson, were probably incorporated from Babylonian sources. When the Jews returned to Jerusalem, only the Pentateuch had been put together into one book, but the grouping of the rest of the historical books was bound to follow. The rest of their literature remained for some centuries as separate books, to which a very variable amount of respect was paid. Some of the later books are frankly post-captivity compositions. Over all this literature were thrown certain leading ideas. There was an idea, which even these books themselves gainsay in detail, that all the people were pure-blooded children of Abraham. There was next an idea of a promise made by Jehovah to Abraham that he would exalt the Jewish race above all other races. And thirdly, there was the belief, first of all, that Jehovah was the greatest and most powerful of tribal gods, and then that he was a god above all other gods, and at last that he was the only true god. The Jews became convinced at last, as a people, that they were the chosen people of the one God of all the earth. And arising very naturally out of these three ideas was a fourth, the idea of a coming leader, a saviour, a messiah, who would realize the long-postponed promises of Jehovah. This welding together of the Jews into one tradition-cemented people in the course of the 70 years is the first instance in history of the new power of the written word in human affairs. It was a mental consolidation that did much more than unite the people who returned to Jerusalem. This idea of belonging to a chosen race, predestined to preeminence, was a very attractive one. It possessed also those Jews who remained in Babylonia. His literature reached the Jews now established in Egypt. It affected the mixed people who had been placed in Samaria, the old capital of the kings of Israel, when the 10 tribes were deported to Media. It inspired a great number of Babylonians and the like to claim Abraham as their father and thrust their company upon the returning Jews. Ammonites and Moabites became adherents. The book of Nehemiah is full of the distress occasioned by this invasion of the privileges of the chosen. The Jews were already a people dispersed in many lands and cities when their minds and hopes were unified and they became an exclusive people. But at first their exclusiveness is merely to preserve soundness of doctrine and worship, warned by such lamentable lapses as those of King Solomon.